Okay, so here we are again. So there was one question from yesterday that I didn't really answer properly. Somebody asked about the meaning of Dhammapada 5 and how to be like such a person. I looked up Dhammapada 5 and I don't think it is the verse that you were thinking of, because as far as I can see, Dhammapada 5 is about hatred is never appeased by hatred in this world. By non-hatred alone is hatred appeased. This is the law eternal. It's a very nice verse, for sure, a very beautiful one in the Dhammapada, but I have a feeling that was not the one you were referring to. So if you want to ask again, please do so, and maybe we can find the right one eventually. Okay, so here we go. Okay, if people don't accept you, how do you hold their lack of acceptance? You cannot really force people to accept you, right? So it seems that you have seen that already, so you have to kind of deal with it in one way or another. In the end, I think that you just shrug it off. That's what you do in the end. If other people don't want to accept you, it's none of your... It's their business, right? It's their problem. People have all kind of strange ideas, and you can be the best person in the world, you can be a saint, and people may still not accept you. So it is not really your problem. Your problem is to do what is right in the world, to do what is good, to treat people fairly, treat them in a kind way. And if you do all that, then you will feel blameless inside, and you will be blameless also in the eyes of all right-thinking people. Sometimes it's just perceptions, right? It's just kind of clashes of personality. All these kind of things happen. So don't worry about getting other people's acceptance. If you worry about that, it's endless. There is no end to trying to get other people to, you know, to value you for who you are. The idea is just remember that it's nothing to do with you, right? This is how you hold it. It's nothing to do with you. It's to do with the other person. It's their perception. It's their understanding. It's their misperception, most likely. Once you can see that and you can accept that, it's not actually a big deal if other people like you or not, if they accept you or not, if they even respect you or not. It doesn't actually matter, because it has to be like that. It's part of life, in a sense. Okay, so there you are. So hopefully, I'm not sure if that really helps, but sometimes it's just a matter of practicing, and you find a solution to these things as you go along. Okay. Dear Ajahn, what is the difference between an arahant and a non-returner? Okay, thank you for a great retreat. Yes, the difference is very, very small. So here we are talking about the kind of loftiest kind of people, you know, according to Buddhism, that it's possible to get. Arahant is somebody who's fully awakened, and the non-returner is the one who's just the level before before becoming an arahant. And the difference is really just that the non-returner has a little bit of perception of self left in them. There's a little bit of self left there. And because of that, they have a little bit of attachment to existence, right? They still want to exist to some extent because the sense of self is there. There's a little bit of attachment to existence. And because there is an attachment to exist, they tend to get reborn in the Brahma Loka, in the Jhana realm, in the future life, in the next life. So that is the arahant. That is the non-returner. But the arahant, there's no attachment whatsoever to existence. There's no sense of self. They don't have want to exist anymore. They don't have a particular wish to die either. But as it says in one of the, I think this is Sariputta's verses in the Theragata, it says that the arahant is like the workman waiting for the wages, right? You have done all the work, you've finished everything you have to do, and then the final wages come when you pass away, and all the suffering finally disappears. So it's a very tiny distinction there between the arahant and the non-returner. Yes? So there is this important distinction in Buddhism between the view of self and having a perception of self. And the view of self is already falls away when you become a stream enterer, but there's still a residue left behind, like a habit, old habit from the past, to view things in terms of self. So very often you will still view things in terms of self, but sorry, you will perceive things in terms of self. But if somebody asks you, you will know the right answer. You will feel the right answer. And then gradually that kind of gets, disappears over time until eventually you become an arahant. Okay, so I hope that satisfies you. Next one. Ajahn, how do we know that the idea of rebirth was proclaimed by the Buddha and not a later addition? Okay, so the way you can never really know anything with absolute certainty, right? But you can know things enough to feel confident about things. And the way you know that is because it is so integral to everything in the Buddhist teachings. It's there, everywhere there, right? In the most core teachings of Buddhism, you find the idea of rebirth again and again and again. And remember, I started off with the Four Noble Truths on this retreat, talking about right view, how to look at the world in that framework. And I was pointing out that the Four Noble Truths are completely integrated. Rebirth is completely integrated into the Four Noble Truths. Specifically mentioned there in a couple of places. It is implied very strongly in a couple of other places. So this is the basic teaching of Buddhism, right? Dependent arising. Rebirth is right there in dependent arising. Another key teaching of the Buddha, one of the teachings that kind of stands out in the Buddhist suttas. So it is very, very highly integrated. The whole purpose of living the monastic or living the spiritual life is to end rebirth, right? What you know when you come, when you're arahant, when you pass away, when you become an arahant, rather, the one thing that you know is that rebirth is ended. So if you take away rebirth, it's like the purpose of Buddhism has kind of been, is not there anymore. It all holds together very beautifully with the idea of rebirth. If you take away the idea of rebirth, it's like the Buddhist teachings, it's almost like you have taken away one of the central pillars, and it doesn't actually hold together anymore. It doesn't stand together. It is very crucial, very central. So what that means is that you can't just take it out. It's not like kind of a, if it was a later addition, you maybe find it. It would have to look like an addition, right? It would have been added on here like a little afterthought or something. But when it's completely integrated, it is really impossible that it could have been added afterwards. It doesn't make any sense unless somebody was trying to fool us big time, right? And trying to integrate everything nicely together and pretending that it was, make it look as if it was original. That's not how it works. When you look at the suttas, it is things that have been added later on. It's always obvious. Nobody is trying to kind of fool anyone else. That's not how the system works. So I think we can be pretty very clear about that. And so if the suttas were spoken by the Buddha, and in general I think it's fairly clear that they were, then rebirth too would come all the way back, go all the way back to the Buddha himself. Okay. Dear Ajahn, are you familiar with the Burmese systematic path to Nibbana? The method recommends developing Samatha first and then Vipassana. Can you comment on this? Okay, the Burmese systematic path to Nibbana. There are many systems in Burma. Burma has a very broad kind of Buddhist tradition, but one of the methods is the Mahasi Sayadaw tradition. That's perhaps what you are referring to. And I have to admit, I don't know that much about it, but it is based very much on the Visuddhimagga and the Abhidhamma, on these things known as the Vipassana Jnanas. And you go through these Vipassana Jnanas, and the idea is then to attain stream entry through that method. But it is based on, it is certainly based on commentarial teachings that are not actually in the suttas. Perhaps what you're referring to here is Goenka's method, and the Goenka idea of then doing samatha, doing kind of breath meditation, and then doing the body contemplation afterwards. That is a bit like samatha first and then vipassana afterwards. So maybe that is what you are talking about here. And one of the things that I have kind of, one of the points that I've been trying to make recently is this idea that somehow you can divide vipassana on one side and samatha on the other side. It doesn't really match with how the suttas talk about these things. The suttas usually talk about samatha and vipassana as a pair. These are results of the practice. So when you practice and you become more peaceful, when you practice and the defilements in the mind are going down, what happens? Because the defilements are going down, you feel more peaceful. That's one of the consequences of the defilements going down. Why? Because defilements take you into the future, into the past, right? But another consequence of the defilements going down is that you see more clearly, because defilements distort your vision. So you gain both clear seeing, which is vipassana, and calm when the defilements go down. And the whole path of Buddhism is about reducing defilements, right? This is what we're seeing here in the Noble Eightfold Path. So the whole path of Buddhism brings two qualities into being, samatha, calm, and vipassana, clear seeing. Both of those come into existence. So the Burmese method of doing watching the breath first, well, if you watch the breath in the right way, that is both samatha and vipassana, because it reduces the defilement. If you then watch the sensations in the body afterwards, and that works, right, it reduces the defilements, which is supposed to do, then it gives rise to both samatha and vipassana. They're just different techniques, but all of these techniques, if done rightly, should lead to both samatha and vipassana. That is how this thing works. So you cannot... This idea that there is one type of meditation that leads to calm and another type that leads to clear seeing, I cannot see that that actually is how the suttas work and how the suttas deal with this. It is more about any type of meditation that works does both of these things. So what the suttas do distinguish between, perhaps a little bit, that distinguish between methods of meditation that are more focused on a particular object, like you're watching the breath, and maybe contemplations, right? You contemplate something. Or you can call it investigation, perhaps. But these are not usually called samatha and vipassana. They're usually called contemplation using the breath. And both of these are complementary things that need to be used together. And both of them should, lead to both samatha and vipassana. So this is how I understand the Buddhist path, and I feel that is straight out of how the Noble Eightfold Path is explained in the suttas. So I hope that makes sense to you. Do the Mahayana traditions have four noble truths and the Eightfold Path? All I hear from them is bodhisattvas. Okay. I also stumble upon the word Sukhavati, or something like Buddha's happy land. Is this the same as Nibbana? Thank you. Okay, so Mahayana tradition, do they have the noble four noble truths and the Noble Eightfold Path? They probably have it. It's because it's part of the broad Buddhist tradition that everybody has, right? But probably what often happens, because they are focusing on the bodhisattva, that means that they are focusing on other aspects of Buddhism. It may be there, right? It's there. They could use it if they wanted to, but probably they are often focusing on other things, focusing on the bodhisattva path, they're focusing on other aspects. That's my general feeling with Mahayana Buddhists, is that the focus is different. But sometimes when you look at actually what people do in their practice, when you look at the sort of things that you cultivate and do, very often the distinction is actually quite small. You see the Tibetan Buddhists are supposed to be Mahayana Buddhists, right? And you see the kind of practices they do, very often it's about compassion and kindness and all these kind of things. And when you look and you compare that to what we do, actually, it isn't that all that different at all. Often it is when you get caught up in philosophy and you philosophize about things, that is when the arguments start. But the amazing thing is that, practically, the difference may be quite small. Okay. The word Sukhavati and something like that, is this the same as Nibbana? Well, if you look at the description of the Sukhavati, this is in a sutta, Mahayana sutta, known as the Sukhavati Vyuha Sutta or something like that, Sukhavyati Vyuha, whatever. I'm no expert in these things, but I have read a little bit of the description of what this is, and it is not exactly, it is very different from Nibbana. It's this happy land where, you know, all the sounds from the trees are just, everything is very beautiful, right? And the rivers flow very nicely, and everything is just kind of magical. It's more like the perfect sensual realm. That is really what it sounds like when you read about it. Everything is just absolutely perfect in the sensual realm. And that's supposed to be where you go, and that's where you become a Buddha in the future, or you get reborn as a Bodhisattva, or whatever. So no, it's not. It's definitely not the same as Nibbana. It is more like it's a kind of a staging post where you hang out and enjoy yourself, and you become a Buddha. You become a Buddha eventually. That's kind of the idea behind that. I think that to me, that this is certainly where the Mahayana tradition goes very wrong in their ideas about the Noble Eightfold Path and about the practice. These are ideas that got nothing to do with early Buddhism, nothing to do with how the Buddha talked about this path. And for me, that isn't really enough to kind of... it's a nice thing for people to aspire to if you want a nice sensual realm, but it's not really what the Buddha talked about, as far as I can see here. Okay, so hope that helps. Okay, dear Ajahn, is the Pitisukha that is experienced just before jhana weak compared to the Pitisukha that come directly after jhana with metta? it's different because before jhana you still have access to the world to some extent. You're not completely cut off from the sensual world, and there's like a shift in perception that happens when you go from before jhana to after jhana. It's like a shift that happens there. So everything afterwards is experienced in a new way. And that's why it's called the Vivekaja Pitisukha, the Pitisukha that is born from Viveka. Is that right, Viveka? Yeah, Vivekaja. Yes, it's born from Viveka, which means seclusion. There's a different type of happiness. It is similar in some ways, because it still has the same kind of name, but it's stronger, more peaceful. It's different because of the peace. It's much more powerful. So it's born of viveka, born of seclusion. Seclusion from the senses and complete seclusion also from the five hindrances. So there's a different feeling to it. But really, these things are very... Here we are talking about really profound things. I think this is something you have to really experience, I think, to really be able to understand the distinctions here. But it's more, even more peaceful, right? Everything goes, is moving towards more and more peace. And that is kind of one of the, it's a kagata, one-pointed, rather than being something movable and changeable. Okay. Dear Ajahn, I have enjoyed listening to your insights on control and influence in our lives. I do wonder about the thought, if we have no control, why bother at all? How do we know when to take charge of our lives and when to let go with metta? Well, the point is that there is a path, right? And if you follow that path according to Buddhism, you will get certain results. Right, the results come from practice that particular path. So it is really what it is about. It's about doing whatever you can so that path actually is developed. That is what the practice is all about. But in terms of the world at large, in terms of kind of how things tend to move, there is very, in that sense, external things that don't have anything to do with you. There's generally speaking very little you can do, and you have to allow things to actually go. With yourself, there's always some guidance you can do in yourself. And once you understand the sort of things you can do, then that is where you should apply yourself. It is possible to change the way we think. It is possible to change our perceptions. It is possible to move towards goodness and develop the good states and reduce the bad ones. These are things you can do. But this is about, in a sense, using wisdom, not so much using control, but using wisdom and then applying that in the right way in your life. That is the sort of thing you can do. The Buddha specifically says in the suttas that it is possible to develop wholesome qualities and to reduce the bad ones. And that, of course, is why he teaches these things. So it's really about your inner life. Your inner life you can do something about. Even then, even your inner life is limited to what you can do, right? You can't make sudden changes. All you can do is make this gradual move in the right direction. Big sudden changes don't normally happen here. So this is kind of the idea of the Buddhist idea of control. It's very limited, but there are things you can do here. Okay. Okay, dear Ajahn, I am considering to buy land far away from both monasteries, about 4 hours distance. Okay, basically it is cheap and my little child can grow up with nature. I would like to live a simple life and continue on 8 precepts. But I feel fear to make a decision to live far away from the Buddhist community when I read that Kalanamitta is 100% necessary for the spiritual path. When the child is grown up, I would like to enter the monastic path. But until then, living as a layperson, it is very easy to get into trouble. When I visit both monasteries and Jhana Grove reminds me of the spiritual path. Could you please give opinions about this? Please forgive me for asking a private question. That's fine. Yes, it is a very important point, right? Remember that anything in life can be measured. Any question, any choice in life can be made on the very simple basis of asking yourself what is going to increase the wholesome qualities in you and what is going to decline the bad qualities. And anything which does that is the right choice. It is nice for a child to grow up with nature. Sure, that may be nice, but it is not necessarily the case that a child who grows up in the countryside becomes a better child than the one who grows up in the city. It also depends on the influence of the child from other people. There are so many things, so many uncertainties there. So it's very, very hard to know. Perhaps that might be better. Perhaps it may not be better. It depends on so many other issues as well. On the other hand, if you live in the countryside, you still have access to the internet, so you can hear talks there. You can still come to Jhana Grove and go on retreats if you want to, and all these kind of things. So you still have that possibility here. So you really have to kind of weigh things up, right? And really, it's very, very hard to know what is the right thing here. That it is cheaper to live in the country, that is no doubt true. I can't really argue with that. So just try to weigh things up. What is possible? What is not possible? What is going to be for the long-term benefit for yourself and your child in a spiritual sense, right? What is going to encourage the good qualities? What is going to make... It's more important for the child to be moral, to have an understanding of certain basic principles than it necessarily is to live in nature, unless that living in nature actually gives rise to those moral qualities. Then it is good. So there isn't really any right answer to this. There is one could be the right, the other one could be right. It's just not really one way or the other. So just think about it. If you have doubts about this, if you don't know what to do, don't make a decision. Only make a decision once you feel that you know the right answer. As long as you have doubts and you make a decision based on doubts, it is quite likely that you may regret it later on. You think, because suddenly it becomes clear to you, and now you realize that was actually the wrong decision. So this is actually, of course, a good chance when you go on a retreat like this. Don't try to think about decisions like this, whether you should go one way or the other. Thinking very often obstructs the natural wisdom that is there. Wait for the decision, for the answer to come to you. And when the answer comes to you, then you know whether it's right or wrong. The answer will usually come eventually. And try to postpone. Try to procrastinate. Procrastinate is a wonderful thing in Buddhism. Don't do anything until you have to, right? It's a great thing. So just procrastinate. Wait. And one day, bang, the answer will come. Then you know what to do. Ajahn Brahm has this beautiful way of making decisions. I told this to one of the other people here during an interview a few days ago. And he says a great way to make a decision is to take a coin, right? Take a coin. And you say, well, if it's heads, then I will go and live in the countryside. Tails, I will live in the city, right? Okay. And put it down. Get it in your palm. Get it in your palm of your hand. And then you look. And then you see your reaction. So, and if you see tails, I have to live in the countryside. Oh, no, I didn't really want that, okay? Then it's the other one, right? Then it's the other one. But if that makes you feel happy, then you know that is the right thing. So this is the coin tossing method with a kind of extra added in. So this is the first one. This is one possibility. You can try that and see if it works. If that doesn't work, make sure you only make a decision when your mind is very clear. If you feel confused, if you feel angry, if you feel upset, if there is desire there one way or another, wait till you have a really nice meditation. The mind is beautiful and peaceful, right? And clarity is there. And then just wait and see if an answer comes to you. If it doesn't come, and you still don't know what to do, then continue waiting. But never make a decision about these things when there is some defilement in the mind that distorts the process of decision making. Third way of making a choice is what I just mentioned. Anything which in the long run will lead to more wholesome qualities arising and the bad qualities going down, that is the kind of choice you want to make. That is, from a Buddhist point of view, that's all that matters in life. The only thing that is worth doing in life, any choice, however you live, is the things that lead to an increase in the good states, the good qualities, and decline in the bad ones. That is all that matters, because that will take you towards the goal that we're trying to reach. Nibbana, samadhi, wisdom, insight, all of those things lie on that trajectory where the good things are going up, the bad things are going down. So that there are some clues on how to make decisions. And apart from that, you are going to have to make that decision for yourself. Okay. Dear Ajahn, it will be extremely beneficial to all of us if you could seriously consider about another retreat, Sutta or General, in November this year, with gratitude, metta, and thanks. That is very kind of you to ask that. Somebody else asked that the other day. And I remembered yesterday, I didn't actually remember, but it came to me later on. I did actually speak to Ajahn Brahm about this. And I think we agreed that it was just going to be too difficult that year to do this. Simply because too many things happening. That's basically the reality. But I will ask Ajahn Brahm one more time and see what happens. But just to be absolutely clear, chances are it is very unlikely, just so that you know what the situation is like. But I will still try just to show my goodwill and do the best I can. Okay. Dear Ajahn, I was once at a retreat center where they taught mindfulness meditation. They claim that the Buddha taught open eye meditation, and this is the technique they taught. Can you comment? Thank you, with metta. Yes, you can do almost anything. There is no limit. There's so many things that can work if they're done in the right way. Remember, what we're trying to do is calm down, right? We're trying to increase the good qualities, decline the bad ones. That is what it's all about. So it really depends where you're at. Where is your meditation at? And if you are, if your mind is very restless and you're not feeling peaceful at all and you're trying to calm down initially, then open eye is okay. You can have your eyes open and just be aware in the present moment. And if it is a beautiful setting, this is why walking around in nature can make you feel good, right? Even though your eyes are open, you can feel peaceful in nature despite the fact that your eyes are open. So it can be done. There's nothing wrong with that. But remember what this is all about. And if it is progressing you in the right way, you can do that. But the point is, the reason we close our eyes is that so much of the input that goes into us comes in through the eyes. I think somewhere I read it, it's about 70 or 80% of all sensory input comes usually through the eyes. Of course, once you close your eyes, more comes through the other senses. But so by closing down your eyes, you're actually closing off a massive source of distraction, a massive source of turmoil, right? We're seeing things, the amount of impression. Just looking out here, the number of colors, the number of lights, everything going on, it's enormous. So by closing that down, you're actually helping to make the mind more peaceful. But it's all about stages, right? What is the right stage? But there comes a stage when it's very obvious that closing your eyes actually helps you to become peaceful. So when that stage comes, then close your eyes and then continue the meditation from there. But if you want to have them open initially, that's fine. Right? So to test it out for yourself. Just remember, there's one simple rule with all of this. You're supposed to be heading towards more peace, right? More peace, more clarity, less defilements. If that's what you're heading towards, anything is okay. That's basically all there is to it. Sometimes people say, what about turning on music? I like to listen to music. Can good Buddhists, can they listen to music? Yeah. This is the kind of question you get, right? So, and the answer is, again, exactly the same thing, right? Does it make you feel more peaceful? You come back home after a stressful day, you turn on a bit of Buddhist chanting, or even just some other kind of nice piano music, right? Or whatever calms you down. It's okay, you can do that. And then when you feel a bit more peaceful, then you can kind of try to go and meditate instead. Not some music you get perhaps too attached to, right? You don't want to get too attached, you have to hear it all the time. But something that just makes you peaceful and calm or whatever. Not heavy metal, anything like that. Right? And then you are kind of heading in the right direction. So use these things. Remember that we are sensual beings. We like sensual inputs, right? Music is sensual input. And sometimes what we have to do is go from the coarse sensual input via the refined sensual input. That's one thing meditation is doing. So the very refined sensual, and then go away from sensuality. It's like a staged process. Everything is staged. So you can never say that anything is bad in its own right or good in its own right. It's bad or good relative to other things and how you're using it. So in the sensual world, make sure that your sensual input helps you on your path, whatever sensual input that you are using. Yeah. Okay. Dear Venerable Ajahn Brahmali, I know the Buddhist path is about relinquishing clinging, but what about the Buddhist teacher? Shouldn't we cling to our Ajahns? I am not so sure we should cling to your Ajahns. That becomes very burdensome for the Ajahns if you cling too much for us. No, cling to the Buddha instead, right? The Buddha is more like an idea. The Buddha is the final teacher, right? He is kind of stands at the head of all of Buddhism. So certainly hold on a little bit, have a little bit of attachment to the idea of practicing the Buddhist path. If there's no attachment there at all, it's unlikely you will actually be doing the practice. So a little bit of right attachment is okay. Remember, as long as we have a sense of self, as long as there is a sense of ego there, there must also be a degree of clinging and a degree of attachment. That's what the sense of self does. It tends to attach to things and to hold on to things. Because the sense of self, once you have a sense of self, there's also things that you own. This is again from the suttas. So you attach, you hold on, you have relationships, all of these kind of things are part of the path. So what we do then, because it is absolutely part and parcel of having a sense of self, that we have a certain degree of attachments, we try to channel that attachment a little bit in the right direction. So you attach more to Buddhism, right? You attach more to the idea of being virtuous. You attach less to kind of, you know, pure indulgence. You attach less to drugs and alcohol, right? You attach less to kind of the things that drag you in the wrong way, and you attach more to those things. And that's a gradual thing. So if you're going to attach to people, attach to the right kind of people. And, you know, So the Buddha is the right kind of person. Attached a little bit to the Buddhist community, maybe not too much to any individual, any special individual. Attached a little bit to the Buddhist community here. And then you're kind of heading in the right direction. It's better to attach to the Buddhist community than to the, you know, the motorcycle clubs or whatever they are. So you choose your crowd, right? Choose the right ones. So clinging to the Ajahns, you know, one of the things about Ajahn Brahm is that it's very difficult to cling to somebody like Ajahn Brahm, because he doesn't really allow you to cling too much. If he feels that you're clinging, he's not going to be too interested in you anymore. So you can't really do that with Ajahn Brahm. And it's kind of nice, you know, because it means that you have to look back at yourself. Well, maybe I'm being too clingy. You know, should I really cling to the teaching? If some teacher doesn't allow you to cling, right? Some teachers want you to cling because it gives them control. They can kind of manipulate you. This is what cults are often made up of. The teacher is somebody who manipulates you because you are attached to them. They are perhaps very, very charismatic, right? And they look at you and you kind of, you know, these kind of things. And you think, wow, this person is really enlightened. And you attach to them, perhaps because you haven't got enough confidence in yourself, enough maturity in yourself. It's often the weak people in the world who attach to these gurus. And therefore, they often get taken advantage of. So it's great to have a teacher who doesn't allow you to attach. Soon as you start to attach, she kind of almost pushes you a little bit away, right? Because that allows you to look at yourself and ask yourself about your own needs. Do I really need this? Should I really attach to somebody? And this is what my experience is with Ajahn Brahm. He doesn't really allow that kind of relationship with a teacher. It's more a purely student-teacher relationship where he teaches you and you follow the advice. Try not to be, you know, clinging a little bit is good, but try not to be too clingy, obviously, because that often causes problems. And especially if you cling to individuals, it is a recipe for disaster. Eventually, individuals will let you down, and then you will feel terrible afterwards. I have seen several examples within the Buddhist community of people who have had very strong confidence in certain teachers. The teacher ended up either doing terrible things or disrobing or whatever, and people were very badly hurt by that when that happened. So it is better to have a general idea, a general attachment to the Buddhist teachings, the Buddha, the Buddhist community, and not so much individuals. That's what I would recommend. Okay. So, dear Bhante, do you think it is detrimental to your spiritual life to have a profession where you are constantly exposed to hearing about and working with trauma, mental and physical? Thank you. I think it depends on the person. I think it depends on your ability to deal with these things, right? If you're able to use the working with trauma to develop compassion, to develop kindness, to develop understanding, then, of course, it can be a positive thing. Because remember, again, it comes back to exactly the same thing. Everything can be measured in terms of this, right? Is it improving the good qualities and declining the good and the bad ones? If it is, then it is working for you. So you have to look at yourself. Do you feel completely submerged in all these problems coming your way all the time? Are you kind of, you can't really breathe anymore because of so many problems? You feel that you're drowning in problems? And if you're drowning in all this stuff, you're not able to kind of hold your place and actually develop yourself in the right way, then there might be a problem. So again, it's individual. There's no right and wrong about these things. Sometimes the first thing to do if you feel that it is difficult is to try to change your perception of the situation, right? Try not to allow the other people's problems to take those on board, take those on board too much. Instead, keep a little bit of mental distance and instead try to have compassion, understanding. Sometimes we get too involved in other people, and when we get too involved, we take on their pain and their suffering. And when we take on their pain and suffering, it can really become unbearable and very, very hard. It's better to not to take it on too much, but instead just to understand that these people need compassion and care. And this is, I think, the ability often of good nurses and good doctors, right? They have a little bit of distance to the patient, but they have enough compassion and kindness to be able to care properly. So you have to try these things. But remember, in the end, it is okay to decide that this is too difficult or too hard. You are not ready for this and you haven't got the spiritual maturity or whatever. And that's okay to decide as well. So you need to do something else. First of all, try to change your attitude, and if that doesn't work, you still feel that you're drowning in problems, then perhaps you should try something else. Okay. Dear Ajahn, in yesterday's Q&A session, you described right mindfulness as coming naturally, stable, sustaining. So right mindfulness is different from the mindfulness we have in doing daily activities. Thank you. Yes, it is, because the right mindfulness that you have in meditation, when the mind becomes peaceful, right, there's very little thinking, there's a natural sense of clarity there, that is quite a refined kind of mindfulness. It's quite powerful. It's not something that you will be able to sustain during your daily life. During their life, there's too much turmoil, there's too much requirement to think about things, there's too much people, kind of, your sensory apparatus is always being kind of overwhelmed by stimulation, right? People saying things you don't like, hearing things, having to do things, having to meet the deadlines. There's a degree of stress, there's all these kind of things. And it's impossible, very difficult, to put it that way. Probably impossible to sustain that kind of mindfulness in that sort of environment. So what you have to do in daily life is slightly different. In daily life, what we have to do is to have enough clarity, enough sampajanya, this is where sampajanya comes in, enough clarity, enough clear comprehension to be able to guide yourself so you don't do things that are wrong, basically. So you keep your sila going, you have enough, you know what's going on, you're able to react to the circumstances around you in a good way, to do what is right, to say a kind word, to do a kind act, to hold back when you feel that your defilements are taking hold, and not to do the wrong thing, to change your perceptions even of people around you. So that is what we should aim for in daily life, have enough clarity that you actually know what's going on. You don't react too fast, too quickly, without being able to properly consider what is appropriate and what is inappropriate at that particular time. That is all I would. I would, you know, sometimes people get into this idea of mindfulness in daily activity, being very mindful about everything. And that's okay, but more important than that is to have a clarity about your virtue, about your conduct. Is your conduct right? Are you being virtuous? Are you doing the right thing? That is more important. If you can combine that with mindfulness, great, but at least make sure that you get the virtuous component right. If you are mindful, really mindful, but you lose your virtue, then it is really completely pointless. Virtue should come first. Have that sampajanya, that clear comprehension, that is really the root. And if you're able to do that, sustain that over time, then you will come back in 12 months' time, next retreat, whenever that is, and then you will find that something has happened. A little bit has happened. You have shifted a little bit, and your peace, your mindfulness will improve during the meditation itself. Okay, dear Ajahn, is Satipatthana Sutta, is it applicable only when you sit down to meditation or throughout the day? Should one organize and be thoughtful of these facts thus? One, contemplating the body, etc., feeling, etc. What is the nature of body, both vanishing and arising, contracted mind, etc., etc. Sadhu, sadhu. The Again, it is the real Satipatthana is something that happens usually when you sit down and do meditation practice. You may have noticed yesterday, or was it this morning probably, we were going through the contemplation of the body, right? And in the full Satipatthana Sutta, it has the awareness or the clear comprehension, the clear comprehension and awareness of the postures during the daily life, of all the things, all the activities during daily life. That is there in the Pali version. But I took it out because it's not there across the board in the various versions of the Satipatthana Sutta. When I say the various versions, I mean like in the Chinese, they have a Satipatthana Sutta. In the Abhidhammas, they have a Satipatthana Sutta. So there's many different versions here. So because of that, it seems that is not a core aspect of Satipatthana. In fact, it seems to me that that is more about what I was talking about just now, clear comprehension. And that is a slightly different aspect on the Buddhist path. Clear comprehension is something, is also part of the gradual training. But it's something that has more to do with this ability just to be aware that you're doing what is appropriate, what is supportive, that you are fulfilling the purpose of the practice, right? And you know that what you're doing is suitable right now to fulfill that practice. Suitability and purpose are two of the four aspects of clear comprehension in the commentaries. And that makes very good sense, at least to me. So this is what you should do. You should try to have enough mindfulness to be able to be aware as much as you can of your sila, of your actions, your speech, and also your mind, if at all possible. And if you can be aware of that, and you have the clarity to know whether you're doing the right thing, then that is what really matters. Because then what you're doing is you're creating the foundation for mindfulness. So when you sit down, the mindfulness will actually be stronger. That is the foundation for mindfulness. Being mindful in daily life, just in its own right, without having the aspect of clear comprehension, is not necessarily going to support your mindfulness. Right? It is the clear comprehension and the guiding of things so you can be more skillful. That is the thing that will support your mindfulness. So that is what matters. Okay. I hope that helps. Dear Ajahn, you explained well. It really increased my devotion appreciation. Is it possible to get a CD of this whole retreat when we leave on Sunday? Metta, thank you. I guess it is being recorded, is it? It is being recorded, so I guess... Not on Sunday, okay. But later on, yeah. So speak to Mahinda. He will be... Are you in charge, Mahinda? Yes? Okay, so Mahinda will be in charge. So have a word with him before you leave on Sunday and organize whatever needs to be organized to get that sorted out. Yeah. Good. Okay. Okay, dear Ajahn Brahmali, thank you for the wonderful retreat. It's very nice to get so much good feedback. People are happy. It's great. So number one, should a thief or prostitute in last life be the same in this life too? What effort can they take to change such attitudes? Sometimes that's what happens, right? Sometimes your habits, they tend to carry on. Why is it that some people become thieves in this life? Why is it that they kind of do all kind of things which may not be very useful? And very often it is that habit carries on from one life to the next one. So it is quite possible that actually may be the case. So what can you do? How can they change? Well, they have to come across the Buddhist teachings, right? Or some other teaching. They have to get that Kalyanamitta, which kind of says, you know, so they understand that this is not the way forward. If you want to be happy, this is not the path to happiness. So this is really what it is about. And in the end, everybody wants to be happy. So if you can convince a person who is doing stupid things that is not going to lead to their happiness, if they feel convinced, they will change, right? So that is really the clue here. The trick is to make them understand that this is not going to lead to their happiness. But it's not often easy. If people are doing something which is wrong, and they believe in that, right? That's why they're doing it in the first place. Or they have attachments. The whole family is kind of into dodgy stuff, right? So because everybody else is, so are they. Like you grow up in a mafia family or something like that. So everybody's into that. So you have to actually make people understand that this is not going to lead to your happiness. That already can be quite hard. So often it is just by example, right? And then they have to get into touch with the right people at the right time. And then something one day may click, and then they might change. So that is often what might happen, what can happen. And again, you know, don't try too hard to change other people. Changing oneself is hard enough. So work on yourself, and then you can become like a beacon to other people. This is what the arahants in the world are. They are beacons to everybody else. When you're fully awakened, people look at you and say, "Wow, this person is just amazing. What's going on here? They are different." Sometimes you don't even see that, because an arahant is often very self-effacing, right? They kind of disappear into a corner. They're sitting there. I love that in one of Ajahn Brahm's books towards the end. I edited that book, that's why I know about this. But this, towards the end of the book, it talks about a meeting with a very famous monk in Thailand called Ajahn Tait. And Ajahn Brahm went there, "I'm going to ask this great monk." He was famous for being an arahant. And he may very well have been one of the great arahants. He died only a few years ago. And Ajahn Brahm went to see him. He had all these questions, right, that he was going to ask this amazing monk. And then he comes to this enormous hall. This was the very end of his life. And the king had built him this enormous palace, right? This is what happens when you become famous. You retire to the forest, and the king comes and builds you this enormous palace. It's weird, isn't it? It's strange. It's what life is like. You give things up, but you can't really give it up. Anyway, he walks into this hall, and then in the corner, it's a big hall, in the corner, this monk sits on a chair, right? And Ajahn Brahm sees this monk, it's as if the hall is empty. It's as if the monk really isn't there. It has this sense of emptiness about it, because there's no self there. There's no personality. He doesn't project any kind of sense of this being, some being anybody at all. So Ajahn Brahm goes in, and he says that in the presence of a person like that, you feel completely at ease, utterly relaxed. You know that nothing can ever go wrong. It's like, and he said that all the questions he had just fell away. He just wanted to sit down right there and be peaceful in the presence of this remarkable monk, right? So this is sort of what happens, and this is kind of what goes on here. So I lost my thread a little bit of what I was talking about there, but. So that's a story from Ajahn Brahm's at the back of his book about this amazing monk and about the arahants and how they become these beacons for the world. That's right. So that is what you should be aiming at yourself. You may not become an arahant yourself. You may not actually get there. But that is the best example we can be. And then once you become an example like that, then other people will really take notice, and they will say, "Wow, that is astonishing." And then a thief, right, or somebody else living whatever life they live, they may be able to be inspired and actually change their lifestyle. Okay, two. Can a gay in the last life enjoy a good bisexual family life with his own children in this life? What effort should he or she take? possibly, I don't know what the answer to that is. I guess if you enjoy being gay, you might be being gay from one life to the next one. I don't know. I guess it all depends on so many different factors. It is very hard to say. But remember, I think it is perfectly possible for a gay person, for anybody really, to practice the spiritual path and also reach awakening, right? It is just all you need to reach awakening is to have five khandhas, to have a mind and a body. And if you have a mind and a body, you go in that direction. Once you get into deep samadhi, remember your gender disappears anyway. Gender disappears in deep samadhi. So you are no longer, these labels, gay or whatever, they kind of fall away. They don't exist anymore after that. So at that point, you are, you know, and when you become fully awakened, you are just fully awakened. These labels don't apply anymore at that stage. You've gone beyond all of that. So I don't really know exactly how karma and these things actually work out. I don't know if it what the answer to that question is, to be honest. Number three, advocating being gay is great for teenagers. Is misleading them as they find it is boring during the middle age, not being able to join their own family with the kids. They end up with frustration and with cats and dogs. It is a very complex question, right? Some couples these days, they don't want to have children anyway, because children, and lots of people don't have children these days. I know in some societies, like in Germany, the number of children per family is going down very rapidly, and lots of couples decide not to have children at all. And, you know, why not? You know, children is a very big burden. It's a lot of thing to do. It may also bring a lot of joy. There's always two sides to these coins, but it's also a burden. So if people don't want to have children, perfectly fine. And perhaps if you want to dedicate your life to a spiritual path very, very fully, then perhaps not having children is not such a bad idea, right? It takes a lot of time, a lot of investment. I have a brother who has two children, a sister who has two children, and I know that for them it is their whole life, right? Children takes up everything, especially when they are young. They take up so much time. It's like, and on top of that, you have your work and everything else. Your whole life really is about your children and all the daily things that you have to do. I don't necessarily the case that you will be frustrated in the later in life. It really, really depends. I don't know if we can actually make those judgments. Instead of wrong advice to be gay, can Ajahn Brahm offer correction to teenagers? Again, this is not Ajahn Brahm's advice to be gay. He's just saying, if whatever you are, that is what you are. And often you cannot change these things, right? I know that in America, especially, there was a lot of, you know, in the conservative Christian circles, again, to be gay was not really acceptable. And they had this re-education camps, right? If you're gay, we're going to re-educate you into being an ordinary heterosexual person. But it doesn't work. That's what they find out. It doesn't actually work. You can't do that. All you're causing is you're causing problems, mental suffering, all kind of things for people trying to kind of change what they are. These are very deep-seated and very deep-rooted things. Instead of trying to change people because we have ideas that this is wrong or whatever, we should accept people. Right, this is what acceptance is all about. If they are good people, if they do what is right in the world, if they, you can be, you know, gay people can be just as good as anybody else. They can be better than anyone else. So look at their qualities, whether they are kind, whether they are compassionate. That is what matters. And this is how in Buddhism we judge somebody, if we judge at all, and even then judgment may not be so good. But the superior person in Buddhism is somebody who has a lot of good qualities. An inferior, if you have to look at it that way, is somebody who doesn't do good things in the world. That is where the difference lies, and that is the important difference on the Buddhist path. Okay. Buddha always corrected the views of non-arahants. Can the non-arahants talk only about what the Buddha said, please? Otherwise, Buddhism is going to be clear as mud. Okay, yes, I think non-arahants, any Aryan, right, anybody who has seen the Dhamma, understands the Buddha's teachings, they can actually talk from the heart. So anyone who is at least a stream entry knows what the teachings are about, they can talk from the heart. But I think it's always nice to come back to the teachings of the Buddha. I think that's very powerful. And especially if you're not an Aryan yourself, I think that is very, very, very useful. So that is that one. So I hope that answers your questions, and go on to the next ones. We've only got two questions or three questions left, so I'll do those quickly, even though time is running out a little bit. Dear Ajahn, listening to you over the past days exploring the world of the Buddha, it is easy to imagine how it must have been like all those years ago listening to the Buddha himself with Ananda seated by his side. We too have Ananda seated in front of you. In the future life, maybe we will still be listening to you exploring the world of the Buddha. I wish a long and healthy life. Purely for selfish reasons. So may we come to your retreats for many years to come. Thank you for inspiring me. That is very, very kind of you to say that. Imagine if you had the Buddha in front of you. That would be incredibly powerful, right? It would really be awesome, as they say, awe-inspiring. But it's true, though. When you read the word of the Buddha, just by reading that, it is a little bit like coming into the presence of the Buddha. That's what I feel when I read the suttas. It's like you are there. The Buddha is actually teaching you, right? This is what is so powerful about it. The Buddha knew that people would be listening to these teachings for a long time into the future. He had us, basically had us in mind. So when you read the word of the Buddha, he is actually teaching you, right? And that is what is so powerful about it. And that is why, in my opinion, it is such a wonderful thing to do, to be able to read that word, contemplate it, and also share it with others. I think that is a great thing to be able to do. Anyway, thank you for your kind feedback here. Dear Bhante, you spoke the other night about the hierarchy in the Buddhist Sangha when talking about bhikkhunis. Can you expand and exactly on what that hierarchy is, please? Can a bhikkhuni ever be at the head of that hierarchy? Thank you, with much metta. Okay, so the hierarchy in Buddhism, actually there isn't supposed to be a hierarchy. The way that the Sangha, the Buddhist monastic community, is laid down by the Buddha, every monastery is self-determining, right? So a monastery with bhikkhunis will be self-determining. A monastery with monks will be self-determining. And within that community, there is almost like a perfect kind of democracy. Every monk has a vote. If somebody tables a motion that one monk doesn't like, you're allowed to block that. So it's not just a majority democracy, it's an absolute democracy where everybody has to agree. And that is actually very nice, right? You have to bring everybody on board. And if somebody doesn't feel comfortable, you have to kind of talk to them and find out why they're not happy, right? And then bring everybody on board in that way. That is very beautiful. You don't have, as I say, the tyranny of the majority over the minority, right? Everybody is kind of brought in. So originally, and this is kind of the strange thing, that originally it was a very democratic and flat structure. Of course, if you were a senior monk or a senior nun, you would have a bit more say because of your maturity, etc. But generally speaking, it was a democracy. So this idea of hierarchy is something that has evolved over the centuries and over the millennia. It is a human thing that I think we need hierarchies. We tend to build hierarchies. People want power, right? People want to be in charge. People think that things are not working right, so we have to control those people who are not doing things the right way. So we build up hierarchies. And these hierarchies are very clear in Buddhist countries, and especially in the countries like many countries, take Burma, for example. The Burma, you have a hierarchy of the Sangha with somebody at the very top called the Sangha Raja. Same thing in Thailand. Slightly similar thing, but a little bit different in Sri Lanka because you have many sects and they each have their own head. But all of these have the head at the top of the Sangha. And then you have a group at the top who makes decisions, right? And then you have regional abbots in various places. And they have regional bishops, rather. And then you have sub-bishops, right? It's a very, very hierarchical structure. And all the monks somehow fall into this. And for many people, being in the Sangha is like a career, right? You rise through these different things. You become, what is it called, Prakru and then Chao Kun. You have five grades of Chao Kun, right? Different levels. And then you become Somdet or whatever. It's just this incredible... incredible hierarchy, and it's this career that you want to practice. And that's what happens, because this is what humans are like, right? We like to kind of social status and whatever, and you lose your real spiritual calling. So that is really what is meant by hierarchy. And of course, those hierarchies in the traditional Buddhist countries, of course, the bhikkhunis are not in there because the bhikkhunis are not even allowed by law, right? The law, they're kind of excluded from the law of the land. So of course, they're not part of the hierarchy here. But if it comes to the point where the bhikkhunis actually become accepted in law in those societies, and eventually it will happen because the bhikkhuni sangha is growing, it's being accepted by the population, everybody are really accepting the bhikkhunis. So eventually society in a legal form is going to have to accept the bhikkhunis. And when that happens, then of course there should be no reason why the bhikkhunis cannot take part in that hierarchy as well. I don't know what it is like in the Mahayana countries, but I understand that in Mahayana Buddhism, the bhikkhunis are often very quite powerful. They're often in powerful positions. I don't know too much about exactly what kind of position we're talking about, but in Taiwan, for example, the bhikkhunis far outnumber the monks. And exactly what the power relationship is between them, I'm not entirely sure, but... Anyway, in theory, there should be no problem. But right now, we're kind of at the very beginning of this emergence of bhikkhunis in the Theravadan world. So it will take time. At the Buddhist Society of WA, we have a spiritual dictator. That's what Ajahn Brahm likes to say, but spiritual director. And there is a vice spiritual director, right? Deputy, whatever it's called. And one is the abbot or chosen by the Sanghat Bodhinyana, and the other one is chosen by the Sanghat Dhammasara. So there's always going to be one nun and one monk being either the spiritual director or the assistant spiritual director. And so far, Ajahn Brahm has been the spiritual director because obviously he is just so incredibly much more senior than any of the nuns. So it's kind of natural, right? I mean, Ajahn Brahm has been a monk for 40 years, and the most senior nun at Dhammasara is about 10 years or something. Yeah. So the discrepancy is very, very big. But in the constitution is written in such a way that it's just as easy for one of the nuns to become the spiritual director and the monk to be the assistant, right? So these roles can be swapped very easily. So there, at least in theory, it's supposed to be equal in the Buddhist society, Western Australia at least. Okay, last question for the night. Ajahn, please explain and put into context the retreats and teachings of Goenka, who promotes vipassana and breath focus as the path to awakening. Is this wrong view or even dangerous? I have family and friends who have attended these retreats. Should I be concerned for their well-being with metta? The answer is that the Goenka retreats, I have never done a Goenka retreat in my life, so I'm only going by hearsay. They are very structured retreats. They are very rigid. You sit for certain amounts of time. Then you do a little bit of walking or something like that, I think. And then you sit again. You have a certain number of sits that you have to do every day. And you basically have to do them. It's very, very strict and very rigid. And for some people, that seems to work. For some people, they're able to do that. Maybe because they have very flexible bodies. Maybe because the meditation is going quite well. They have the right... it works. But for the majority of people, these kind of retreats are very, very difficult to endure. And I understand that only 10%, I think, of Goenka retreatants return to the retreats simply because it is just too difficult to endure these things. I don't really agree. I like Ajahn Brahm's method of allowing people to feel for themselves what works, right? To have the easy way, find the middle way, don't torture yourself. There's bound to be a lot of self-torture when you have to sit for those kind of periods of time. And you have to sit on the cushion in the middle of the hall. I don't think there's any chairs on the Goenka retreats. Is there chairs on the Goenka retreats? You can't one with backs. Okay, so there's a little bit of comfort there. Okay, that's good. So basically, that I think is a danger. But again, this idea of dividing vipassana and samatha into two separate aspects, I don't think it is quite right. I mean, these are just labels anyway, right? Sometimes we get caught up in labels. The point is, any practice that is practiced rightly, you can do many different things. You can use reflection practices, reflecting on death. You can watch the breath. You can even watch the feelings in the body. I don't think the Buddha ever actually taught that. There's no such thing in the suttas as watching the feelings in the body. But it is not kind of excluded either, right? It can come under Vedana Nupassana. So it's certainly not wrong. But the main point is, if it gives rise to peace, if it gives rise to samatha, and it gives rise to clear seeing vipassana, if these are the qualities that come out of whatever you're doing, whether it's watching the feelings in the body, watching the breath, just being peaceful, doing a maranasati, death contemplation, whatever it is always measured by that. It's always measured by whether it gives rise to these positive qualities. That is what matters. So there is no such thing as something being right or wrong in itself. It is what effect it has on you that really matters. So I must admit personally, I'm not sure if the Goenka method is the ideal method for the majority of people, even though it is very widespread. And that is, of course, the good thing about Goenka. It is so widespread, everybody gets a chance to try this, which is very nice, and that is very useful. But I think I would prefer something a bit more relaxed, a bit more easygoing, a bit more emphasis on the full understanding of all the Buddhist teachings rather than a very narrow focus, which I understand is what is happening there. But I am no expert. And in the end, it is how it works for you that really matters. Okay, so that is this evening's Q&A. So we'll see you again tomorrow morning here.